listener production.
Shares.
Market.
The S&P.
The ASX.
Stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that is soon to become an all-encompassing platform of its own. One of the platform members will be Mr. Andrew Page. How are you, buddy?
Very good. Love a good platform.
You do love a good platform. I love a good platform too. I'm looking forward to that conversation. If you've read the bio of the episode, you'll know a little bit about what we're going to chat about, but we might keep that one up our sleeve. Before we do, how's your week been?
Yeah, it's been pretty good. Sun's shining again, which is nice.
Nice, isn't it?
Yeah, beautiful. So maybe the last hurrah before winter sets in, but yeah, I'm enjoying it. Mate, I love autumn. I'm a big autumn fan.
Hey, I'm in Barrel, as our listeners know, and this week, I think it was Wednesday or Tuesday, we got a high of 9 degrees. Mate, winter is here. Don't worry about autumn. We went from really nice and balmy to 9 in the space of about 3 days. Unfortunately. Yes, there are places to be in winter. Well, Barrel's beautiful in winter, but it's always cold. The winters are long. So,
and yet I'm looking at you and you're wearing a t-shirt.
Well, it is. It's going to be 17 today, so that's okay. It's getting back up there.
Balmy.
I know, yes. Exactly. That's about as high as it'll get for the next 9 months or 6 months. So. In the meantime, we will get on with the podcast. Mate, the only thing I did want to ask is strawman.com still a private online investment club?
Sure is. Okay. It sure is. Right. Yep.
Just changes checking. There. You don't want to assume these things. it may at some point morph into a Bitcoin exchange. I'm not ruling that out. So we'll see how things pan out.
You never know.
Mates, let's start with the macro and some disappointing news out on, was it Thursday, Wednesday night, Thursday morning our time. US inflation. Had been 3.2% on an annual basis, jumped to 3.5%. Apparently, housing and petrol or fuel, echoes of Australia, pushing prices up. Not ideal, not good at all, and obviously concerns about what it might mean for Australia. We won't go into RBA or necessarily even interest rate predictions necessarily. That being said, we followed the Yanks into inflation. We followed them as they started to kind of, you know, benefit from lower inflation, or as you would like to say, just simply a slower rate of price increases. Yeah. But you know, it does seem unlikely that we can, you know, when the RBA tried to believe early on that inflation was only a US problem, it was never going to happen here, that was always wishful thinking. Surely it's wishful thinking to imagine that inflation won't at least be at some significant risk of bumping up here before it goes back down.
Yeah, I mean, this is a hard one without going over a lot of old ground that we've covered on the pod, but it is watching a train wreck in slow motion in a lot of ways. You know, you have to sort of wait month or two to get any new data, and we all the expectation is very broad that everything will roll over towards the end of the year and we just keep getting these reads that suggest, well, maybe not as fast and as soon as we all think. And look, I've been on the record for a while saying that I think we were past the peak, but it's going to be stickier than I think a lot are expecting. It is funny. It is funny though, the degree of what's the word? You know, the hyperbole in the headlines and the reaction on markets. Yeah, it was 3.5%. Yeah, the target is 2%. The consensus before going into this was 3.4%. So, you know, it's I get it. It's worse than what we thought, but it's 0.1% worse than what we thought.
And the US market fell by 1%, and the Aussie dollar against the US dollar strengthened. Yeah. So it strengthened against the Aussie dollar by 1.8%. And you're like, guys, what like 0.1%? You know, look, the fact it's up, it was going to go up anyway. It was still up to 3.4 if that happened. Markets sound like shocks. And it's, I say that kind of, it's obviously true. It's also just something, again, it's just a nice reminder that people are idiots and people are markets. And, you know, it's like when people assume businesses are always going to be logical and rational. I'm like, I've worked for managers. I've met CEOs. You know, they try to be rational. The intent is rationality. When people are involved, it diverges from the script very quickly.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And the other thing to just note, again, it's been this way for a little while, but it's sort of dropped out of the conversation, is that without getting too technical, but the yield curve is still inverted. In other words, if you just plot a chart.
I hadn't noticed that.
Yeah. So if you just sort of say you put the different maturity of bonds out there, so 6 month, year, 3 year, 5 year, 10 year, and then you plot the yield on those. Usually it goes up and to the right, which makes sense. Like if I'm going to lend you money for 10 years, I want more compensation than what I would expect if I was going to lend you money for 1 year. Mm. But every now and again, it inverts where, and this is the point now. So the current 10-year yield on treasury bonds for the US is 4.5%. So people, this does my head in too. People are out there going, I will lend you money for 10 years and all I expect is 4.5% back. It's like, wow, that's the best you can, anyway. So people do that. But on the 2 year, it's 4.9%.
Right.
Now, you can get into the reasons as to why that may or may not be, but what is very interesting here is, and I'm always very skeptical of anything that purports to be too predictive, yet observational fact is that before every recession, the yield curve has inverted. I think if you go back to 1950 or something like that, it's tended to be a very good predictor of that. It also tends to be something that can be anywhere up to 1.5, I think, on average, but up to 3 years lag from when that yield curve inverts to when you see the recession appear. And I guess the thing to remember here is the yield curve is based on future expectations, like the share market.
Yeah.
So, and people are basically saying, I don't have an encouraging longer term outlook. So I only need 4.5%, 2 years and that kind of stuff. I'm still going to need a little bit more because, you know, I'll have to roll that over at some point.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I guess one of the other points I like to make in regard to bond yields and that too, because it can get very abstract, but we spend a lot of time talking about what central banks are doing with interest rates, right? The bond market is really the one in control here. You know, I don't remember that Batman movie with Bane in it and there's the counselor saying, I'm in control here. And then Bane puts his arm on his shoulder and goes, do you feel in control? That's the bond market to central banks, right? Because it's an open and free market, right? People will buy bonds at the prevailing market price if they feel as though it makes sense. Whether they're right or wrong, that's what they're doing. People right now on the most liquid, largest fixed interest market in the world, US Treasuries, people are sort of saying, I will take 4.9% for 2 years and only 4.5% for 10 years. And the Federal Reserve can set interest rates whatever it likes. And yes, that has consequences for interbank loans and sort of the mechanics that go on behind that. But in terms of what the market will fund low-risk entities, including governments and big institutions at, that really sets the needle. Because if the market's not going to come to the party, there's the buyer of last resort are the central banks themselves. And when they are the buyer of last resort, they're not. I mean, they're printing the money, right? I know it sounds conspiratorial, but they are. That's literally what they are doing. Well, not literally. It's on a database. It's not. They're not cranking the paper printers. But that obviously increases the money supply. That obviously has impacts to inflation, and then you get into these kind of sort of really difficult spirals. Yeah. So
it's also true the yield curve being inverted is not an accident of. It's not causally predictive. It tends to be correlated, and it kind of makes sense because, you know, it tends to be the case that governments will put interest rates up or central banks put interest rates up to achieve certain aims, usually to slow a overheating economy. Mm-hmm. And more often than not, and I know you have your issues with this, that will end in tears or pain or at least at some point lower rates. You know, the fact that rates are cyclical kind of makes sense. If you think about, well, hang on, central banks probably going to increase rates and they're probably going to drop rates after that. Mm-hmm. i.e. we're now coming towards a potentially loosening bias, or as the Boffins like to say, they're going to start dropping rates from probably what I think the current rate's probably the peak, unless everything goes really, really weird from here. So it kind of makes sense, right? If you're going to say, well, hang on, if I had to plot that, you know, no one knows for sure, but the people who are doing those predictions are saying, well, I think it's probable that central bank interest rates are lower in a year's time than now, and probably lower in 2 years' time, and probably lower in 3 years' time, or at least – you know, they might go back up again by then, but probably still lower than where they are right now if this is going to be the peak in the cycle. So it makes sense. If you're going to say, well, I'll put money away for 2 years, it's the same as people thinking about a term deposit, right? It's like, well, I can lock in a term deposit at today's rate, but I should want to pay less because over that time, the variable rate's going to fall. So locking in today's rate would be mad. And so it should make sense that the longer, if you're in a loosening kind of part of that cycle or a rate falling part of the cycle, it makes sense that you should have a lower interest rate out further because you're going to that's the market you're going to be operating in as the opportunity cost effectively of treasury new treasuries being issued by the central banks. So that kind of makes some sense. I just want to make that point because people kind of think, oh, the yield curve is inverted, therefore that will do this thing. It doesn't really do anything.
Oh, it's not causal. No.
Right. It just demonstrates to everyone who wants to look, because the graph is printed and you can look at it and say, okay, it's just the market saying rates are going to go up, then they're going to go down. And more often than not, when rates peak in the past, after particularly decent, you know, booms or economic activity booms anyway that we've had in the past few years, that's why you end up with inverted yield curves. That's why you end up with rates dropping. That all they're saying is rates are probably going to be lower over that period than they are now. And the longer you have those lower rates, the less you need to pay or are prepared to accept out that 7 or 10 years potentially. Now, as I said, the only reason that is considered correlated with recession, as it tends to be in the past, why is it correlated with recession in the past? Because exactly that sort of thing happens. You get the boom bust cycle. So, you know, is there a chance that we end up with a recession? Yeah, because when booms bust, that's kind of what happens. And rates will probably fall to compensate for that. And they're likely to be correlated rather than causal. And again, I wasn't saying you were saying that. I just want to make that clear for everyone
You're dead right. I mean, markets are pretty good at sort of, well, I mean, it's almost definitionally true. They will reflect the consensus sentiment. And think about it. I'll flip it around another way. So you're an investor. You've got a bit of money that you could put aside. And you think things are just going to be great over the next 10 years. Markets and economies are going to be booming. Company profits are going to be rising. Living standards are up. I mean, I'm not going to put my money in a government bond and earn a little bit of interest. The bond market's going to have to tempt me with a really decent interest rate because otherwise I'm going to go buy Nvidia or something like that, right? So it's only when people sort of say, no, I really don't think there's going to be great returns elsewhere and I'll just take this, thank you very much. That's sort of the dynamic that is playing out here. And what's informing those opinions is everything that everyone is looking at, you know, whether it be unemployment, whether it be rates of default, whether it be, you know, every single economic bit of data. So that's why it is nice in a way because it is a distillation of all of that writ large by the market through the interaction of all these individual players sort of saying, well, this is what I expect. That what everyone expects can often be wrong. Let's not remember that. And no one knows the timing of things. But where you can be objective with these data points is to sort of say, well, right or wrong, majority of people think that the future is not great. And historically, that view has been borne out.
Yeah.
Now, do you take the next step and say, all right, head for the hills and grab the baked beans and the shotgun? No, not necessarily.
Exactly.
But it is noteworthy and I'm making the note.
No, I think that's a really good point, mate. I mean, obviously, it matters for most people, frankly, most of us in the context of mortgages and you know, as much as there are bond markets and there are global machinations and there's just how much is my repayment this month? And that's, you know, the bad news might be that the longer inflation stays sticky in the States. Maybe it goes up here. Maybe it doesn't. Maybe we get lucky, right? We talk about being lucky, I think, on next week's episode because we pre-recorded that one. But yes, the idea of the lucky country, maybe we get lucky, but statistically and probabilistically, it's not a lot of – the odds aren't great that we're going to diverge from the US in any meaningful way on inflation because these are just global realities.
We're all interconnected, you know. And just can I just draw one more line here just to make it a bit more direct for people?
Yeah.
So – you know, what the hell has this got to do with my mortgage rate, I guess is what most people are thinking. And again, there's an open global competition for capital. And so the bank, you know, needs to lend money out at a rate that it's more than it is that it is borrowing from. Now, a lot of that borrowing from the bank's point of view comes from you, the depositor. You put your money in, they lend it out. In Australia, they actually there's a shortfall there and they make up the difference by going to international investors and issuing bonds. So, you know, CBA can try as hard as it likes to go and raise, you know, $100 billion at 2%. They're not going to do it. No one's going to buy it, right? Because I can get a better deal elsewhere. So when these global interest rates and this competition for capital is as it is, you know, you're subject to what the market is prepared to pay. And again, you can't point a gun at someone's head and say, you will buy my bond and you will be happy with it. It's like, unfortunately, fortunately, it doesn't work that way. So this is very real. This is very real stuff. And this is where I guess it for me, it gets concerning is when the counsellor does think that they are in control and ignores the big nasty Bane sitting over there in the room, and you start sort of doing all this stuff. It's kind of like at a point the market, people and institutions and the making these capital allocation decisions just say, no, you're going to have to tempt me more than that. You just are. Yeah. And if you go, well, no, I don't, I can do whatever I like. Well, you've got to buy your own stuff effectively. And that messes things up. You're just often done with the best of intentions, but gosh, the implications of that. It really just screws with the entire market. Trust breaks down. Faith in the future, optimism in the future breaks down. Your wallets tighten up. People aren't prepared to spend and invest. That loses jobs. I mean, this is what I find so fascinating about this stuff. I know it's such a dry topic at the surface level, but it impacts all of us, whether you're a Zimbabwean farmer or you're living, you know, in Barrel in New South Wales, right? Like it is that big. And I think it we get lost a little bit in the jargon and we lose a little bit of the direct threads that are joining all of this kind of stuff together. Mm-hmm. And so just to come full circle before we move on in the conversation here, what has really happened since we last spoke about this is that inflation is proving stickier than most had thought. Interest rate decisions from the Fed, an interest rate easing is less likely and less soon than what it was. The bias sort of still remains there. But it's hamstrung by what the broader market is doing. The broader market is saying we're not confident of the future as we were. And if you want our money, you're going to have to tempt me with higher rates.
If you're an institutional investor, that's true. But I want to take a tangent to something. I didn't have more you on this one, mate. We aren't probably
talking about it.
But you mentioned the borrowings of Australia's banks. There's some data analysis out this week from Macquarie. They reckon Commonwealth Bank earns $1.7 billion a year, more than it would if its customers shopped around.
Mm-hmm. I believe that.
$1.7 billion. Basically, and they're talking about here not about mortgage payers. They're talking about depositors. In other words, the money that we leave in our bank accounts, which we could earn more elsewhere from, our lethargy, and I mentioned CBA. I don't know. I haven't seen the original report. I saw a report of the report. So I don't know if the other banks were included or whether CBA was just called out because it's the biggest bank with the biggest deposits, so it makes the biggest headline. But the cost of not shopping around. We often talk about mortgages or we talk about insurances or internet, telephone, that kind of stuff, gym memberships, whatever. $1.7 billion from Australians to CBA because we're going to go, well, we could go over there and get the online savings account with 3 or 3.5 or 4%. I'll leave it in the CBA account with 0.5% or 0.1% or 1% or something else. The sheer dollars at bank for CBA are so massive that they apparently make $1.7 billion more than they would if they had to pay market rates for those deposits.
Dude. So I'm out myself here in like my level of business incompetence. So we've got a business bank account with Strawman, obviously, and there's some money in there. And I was chatting to one of the other part owners the other day, and it's sort of like, what interest do we get on that? It's like, that's a good question. I assume it's not much. You know, it's not there to earn interest. In fact, it's just working capital, and there's not that much there anyway, really, to be honest. But guess how much interest I get?
How much?
Zero.
Oh, no.
Zero.
The old business transaction account, hey?
Yep, because it gives me the flexibility to transfer money. It's like, I've got basic bank account functionality. Come on, man. And you know what I've done about it?
Go on.
Nothing. I mean, I should, and I probably will at some point. Again, like if there was $2 million sitting in the bank account, I would do something about it, right?
Yes, exactly.
But it just highlights your point it's just the bank offers a worse deal because it can.
Because it can. Correct. Yeah.
And you know, and who's to blame? You know, shake your fist at the bloody banks. No, it's your fault.
Exactly.
And it's my fault.
Yeah.
And it's all of our fault, right? Yeah. Like, go somewhere else. Yeah. Go on. And I mentioned to you off air the other day, it's just sort of like, I think we were talking sort of about competition and how that's such a good balm for you know, poorly performing corporates and the rest of it.
That. Yeah.
And I've just thought one of the most elegant, beautiful solutions to that was just have those portable bank account numbers where if I can pick up the phone or go to a website within a few clicks or a 5-minute conversation, just say, I'm picking up my business and I'm taking it from CBA to Westpac. Yeah. You watch how quick these things resolve themselves because they know, as insurers know, as telcos know, as utilities know, mm-hmm. that it's just sort of like people will tolerate irrationally, and we all do it, a certain amount of pain in, rather than having to deal with the hassle of filling out some forms. And let's face it, any of these call centers, any of these websites is like one of the inner rings of hell whenever you're dealing with a larger company. Like, I will happily pay more money than to, you know, give my details for the 100th time to some bot that doesn't understand what I'm saying. You know, and it's all, you know, again, I would sort of say it's not entirely unintentional. You know, you don't want a seamless, smooth transition.
Are you telling me that when people say we're having higher call volumes than usual, they're not being honest?
Well, I've never made a call where that hasn't happened. Exactly. Maybe I'll call it 3 a.m. on, you know, New Year's. Christmas Eve one morning just to see if that's true. But
you would too.
Yeah. Anyway, I don't know, way off topic there. I don't know if I had a point or not. Other than your comment about what Macquarie said, I 100% believe it. And I almost kind of, you know, as far as CBA is concerned, it's like, yeah, good on you. If I was a shareholder, I'd be saying, exactly. Well, if you can do it, you know? And if someone listening to this is unhappy about it, then don't bank with CBA, right?
Like and again, they're all the same. But the point is every bank, it's not just, CBA's not the only one doing this. There are other banks who are also saying, I'll take advantage of my, the answer is don't leave your money in a low interest account if you have other options. You're gonna have to be, you know, I probably will directly disagree with that, only in the sense that, a bit like, as you say, blaming the banks. Like, well, they do it because they can. So every bank's going to do it because they can. Every business does it because they can. That's how prices are set, right? When there's no competition, we'll get to that in a minute. That's kind of how things go. Yeah. I want to just quickly, because I've been reading Boomerang by Michael Lewis to the audiobook recently. And I want to make you the malevolent dictator of Australia for 30 seconds or a minute.
Oh, bring it on.
You may not take us to Bitcoin as our
money standard. I was going to say, first point of order.
You may not disband the RBA. So there are limits to your dictatorship enforced by dictat from the government.
Fix the money, fix the world, my friend.
Apparently. And reading that, there's a lot of banks doing stuff because banks were doing stuff. Other banks were doing stuff. You know, the Irish banks got in trouble because they were doing that. The German banks. The amazing thing about this is not that Germany didn't do anything wrong, except they funded everyone else doing everything wrong. Mm-hmm. Germany was some of the biggest investors in the Irish property development banks. They were some of the biggest investors in the US subprime stuff. Apparently on Wall Street they had a line: if you couldn't sell one of those, you know, the old CDOs, the collateralized debt obligations, they'd say you call the banks in Dusseldorf, because there was a couple of banks in Dusseldorf who would just do it because everyone else was doing it and they didn't know they were making mistakes.
Yeah,
and I guess so the reason I'm making you benevolent dictator for a minute is play the game theory through on this. You know, one of the great, again, speaking of the lucky country, we were well regulated. Maybe the banks just stupidly profitable, didn't need to. But for whatever reason, our banks almost exclusively avoided the worst of the GFC, of the subprime crisis, the global financial crisis. Aussie and Wizard, two kind of funders who decided to, was it, borrow long and sell short, the other way around, I can't remember which. But basically, they got their, you know, they funded 30-year mortgages with 30-day revolving paper, and when that dried up, their business, you know, imploded.
Every single time.
Right?
Like, every single time that happens.
Correct.
Like, there's no
Valley
exception.
Bank happened another 15 years later. It's like,
exactly.
Who'd
happens
thought?
All the time.
But our banks didn't. And I, the game theory I want to ask you is, if you're not, Andrew Page, the competition zealot, or Andrew Page, the bank hater, or Andrew Page, the Bitcoin lover. Any of those things can be true or not true, but I don't see you disagreeing. but Andrew Page is a benevolent dictator, because there's some game theory which says, I don't mind if our banks make an extra couple of bucks if it means the financial system is actually a little more stable and we actually don't have to worry about, or choose not to worry about, or don't let them do some of the stuff that some of the idiot banks around the rest of the world did. And again, I'm not saying they individually deserve it or are better or whatever. I'm just saying, if you're responsible for 27 million Australians, a couple of extra percentage points on the, or, you know, a fraction of a percentage point on their profit because of that sort of stuff. Part of me is kind of like, there is some big social contract game theory, something, which is, if I don't move my money, if other people don't move their money around, and CBA is a bit more profitable, and ANZ is, and NAB is, and Westpac is, and the system is kind of more secure, and they're not chasing those extra, you know, some of the German banks got in trouble because they basically said, well, Irish, one of the two, the amount they were paid for risk reduced, so they took on more risk to make the same amount of money. You know, if your margin halves, you sell twice as much stuff. So they literally invested in twice as much crappy stuff because the fees were going down. And there's part of it which is just maybe our banks avoided it just because they were kind of cushy, and maybe that wasn't such a bad thing. And I know that seems like a silly thing to say, but it's a kind of a worthwhile thought experiment, right?
I mean, yeah. The trouble is it's a continuum. So you're right at a point and you're wrong at a point. Yes, I don't know where that line is. So we did avoid it. Well, let's remember all the major banks recapitalized. They all did raisings, emergency raisings at the time.
But that was actually largely preventative out of just in case something goes wrong. None of them needed that money in the end.
Well, they didn't know they didn't. Exactly. Right. It's like, we might need this. Yes. Let's do it. Like, and the market seems as though they'll lend us some. Let's do it. It is a five-second conversation at the board level.
But it wasn't they didn't need the money because of malfeasance at their level, at their end.
Well, you know what? Yes. But what is telling is that they were hyper alert to the possibility that they could need it. And this is the thing to remember with banking is it can change overnight. Like Silicon Valley Bank is a good example, It literally, their deposit base just dried up, almost instantly.
Went away,
And on the balance sheet side of things, it's just like they were insolvent. You know, they had obligations that they couldn't fulfill. And all banks operate on this continuum. Let's keep it really simple here because things are going to get really complicated quickly. Mm. But if I'm a bank and I'm a full reserve bank, say, and I have $100 of depositors' money and I lend you $100, and let's say I duration match because I'm not an idiot. But so if I'm going to lend you for 30 years, I'm going to say to the other person, like, your money's locked up, right?
Yep, yep.
This is very ancient Mesopotamian banking 101. Sure, right? This is kind of where we started, right?
Right.
And it made a lot of sense because you can't ever go too wrong here, right? Mm. Now let's say that I've got $100 in depositors' money and I lend out $200. I'm fractionally reserved. That's probably okay because most people don't need most of their money most at the time.
They're not going to call it straight away.
And if someone does, someone will be depositing money elsewhere and the system all kind of balances out.
And they keep some reserve cash just in case there's short-term, they call it a tier one equity ratio. They've got some money left aside just in case a few more people than expected come and get their money.
Absolutely. Yep. Now, what is that reserve ratio? Is it 50%? Is it 80%? Well, it's about 10%, I think, internationally. It might be 12 or something.
Most of Australia seem to have about 12 or 13%. Yeah, but yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So in other words, should their asset base drop only like an eighth, they have more liabilities than assets. Yes. They're insolvent. So, and again, I don't want to worry, but just that it tends to be a standard to which we've found that it's usually okay, depending on, here's the big asterisk, where you've actually lent it. If you've lent it into a bubble, then that's probably not going to be good. If you've lent it very sensibly, then you're probably okay. But again, the whole system's based on trust. As soon as people go, I don't know if you're good for, I've lent you money effectively.
I'm assuming it's going to be there when I want it.
But if I don't think it, even though there's a chance that it might not be and I can click a few buttons and just transfer it to another, I'm going to do that, right? So things rapidly change. And my point is, just to come back full circle on how you laid things out, we didn't get into all of that strife, but it was the gap between where our banks were structured and those banks wasn't as wide as I think people assume. So we dodged it. When the room started filling up with water, our shoes were tall enough that our nose stayed above the water.
Yep.
And there were other people that are a couple inches shorter and they just weren't as lucky.
Correct.
But I don't think it was something that it was just like, oh, we were always going to be fine. It was like, well, if actually things deteriorate, I don't know, I'll make it up, deteriorated 10% more than, we would have happened to us as well.
Except that just quickly, our issue would have been counterparty risk.
It's always the risk. Yeah.
But I guess my point is our banks didn't make counterparty once removed. So our banks didn't make the stupid investments. They weren't piling into Icelandic, money management. They weren't investing in Irish builders. They weren't,
not to the same extent.
Not really much at all. The CDO's exposure was almost zero. In Canada there was only one bank, TD Bank, that didn't play the game. Everyone else played the game because everyone in the US played the game because TD Bank kind of went, we don't really understand this. We think it's silly. Yeah. Everybody else was like, well, they're doing it. I guess we better do it too. We all want to make money. We've got to make some profit.
That's the game theory part, isn't it?
Well, that's what I'm saying. And that's where I kind of get back to our banks of, I don't mean to suggest they are preternaturally or somehow specially better or different.
Mm.
But I think there is some sense that for whatever reason, and I guess I'm presuming or assuming that maybe it's because they're profitable enough, they didn't feel the need or desire to play that game. They simply said, those guys over there are trading CDOs. We could do that, but we're not going to. And I guess the game theory bit I'm talking about is they kind of went, we don't need to do that because we're actually profitable enough and we're fine here. And
are they doing just kind of fine with their own property market?
Which is kind of my point, right? But that's almost my point is, you know, if there was portable banking, if their margins fell by half, would there be someone at CBA or NAB who says, we're going to try and find another profit stream here. What we should do is start proprietary trading CDOs.
Yeah, potentially. Yep.
You know, and that's a bit I'm curious about. I'm always mindful with banks in particular of saying, yeah, would I like to make a little bit less money on behalf of every Australian depositor and mortgage holder and, you know, business customer? Yeah. But I'm also kind of like, there's a limit at which you say, I'm kind of okay with them just doing a bit more than okay if it means things are a bit more stable than they would be if they started playing silly buggers to chase the next fraction of a percentage point of profit growth.
Yes, but the issue I've always had here is what they call moral hazard.
Yes,
there's a part of me that kind of says let the banks do whatever nonsense they want to do. I don't care. You want to do that, fine. If I'm not comfortable with that as a depositor or as an investor, I won't play that kind of game. But play stupid games, win stupid prizes is the saying. And I feel as though the moral hazard part comes into it and game theory comes into it because it's never explicitly said. No one's signed a contract. No one's had a meeting. But Matt Common knows that if things get real, we're going to bail him out. Oh, right? And it's kind of like, and he also knows
that it's explicit. The government's got that $250,000 deposit guarantee. I mean, depositors will be effectively made whole up to that level. And frankly, if it comes to it, probably more because the government may just voluntarily say, all right, we'll keep you all happy so we don't cause the run on the bank that they fear. You're right. Depositors particularly will be backstopped.
I think, so this is really harsh, but I think let them fail. Let them fail because that's the incentive not to do this. When your whole operation is facing existential risk or you're playing in an area where there's existential risk, the investment committees will be like, you know what, let's not, because if we do this, there's every chance that we blow up. If instead the conversation is, let's do it. Like it might go for 5 years before the party ends. We'll make $1 squillion and worst case scenario, we're going to get bailed out. I might miss my bonus for a year and why not? So it's got to, there are systemically important reasons as why you need, I've often referred to Charlie Munger's quote, you know, capitalism without failure is like Christianity without hell. And it's such a good line because that's the incentive. For all of us shaking our fists at the sky saying, the bank should do this and they should be nice and they go around and it's like, no. Let them do what they like, but just understand that the cost of failure is death in the corporate sense. And that sharpens the mind. And that, I think, would lead to much better market outcomes. Now, before I know what you're going to say, okay. And I would say if I would have minimum deposit guarantees. And I wouldn't make it unlimited, but to a certain point. So depositors will be made whole.
Yes.
But if the bank has to fail, the bank has to fail. Right?
Is that going to happen anyway, mate? I mean, we saw Lloyd's was 90% owned by the UK government. All the Irish banks were effectively taken on the Irish government balance sheet. I don't suspect the Australian government would bail out shareholders. I could be entirely wrong. Maybe they're more craven than
Well, they
I
did
believe.
For Qantas just recently. It's exactly what they did. Why? Because Australia, you know? Yeah, and I'm like, what? And it literally just happened. And so I'm not saying it's a guarantee. And look, you're right. I shouldn't be so deterministic. But it's on the cards, right?
That's possible. I agree with that, absolutely.
I could imagine too, especially when the big cohort of people are going, all my money was there, they did this, who's going to do something? And the politician who gets up there and says, well, actually, this is just the nature of markets. We will teach them a lesson and in the long run, we'll all be better off with a more robust anti-fragile system. Yeah. No, you say, I'm going to do something. Just like we're having a supermarket inquiry right now, just like we're going to have any number of other dumb inquiries or what's Elbow on now? We're going to like incentivize manufacturing or something. Yeah. You know, I think this is where fundamentally we often differ on things is I think you're right in everything you say, but you have more faith in the power of institutions than I do, or the intent and capability of institutions.
Because
with a very capable, competent, fair, honest administrator of these things, I'm with you. But there's not a lot in history that gives me confidence that that's going to be
And for what it's worth,
case.
I'd actually agree with you in terms of the failure bit. If we talk about the equity base rather than the whole of the business. And I make, again, separating out the shareholders.
Yeah.
So
yeah, you're right.
We end up in the same place, which I would absolutely let the shareholders of CommBank fail. We should not, I'm sorry, any CommBank shareholders or ANZ or Westpac.
Well, everyone, CommBank. Every single person listening is exposed because through your super, it is such a major part of the, there is no one in Australia that doesn't have direct exposure, which is why I think they would be bailed out. But yes,
I will say, so the only thing I know, you know, I kind of come back to this sometimes, I think I am more worried about the so-called principal agent problem, as they call it in the, in the theory. Yeah. So, and again, Lewis talks about this in the book. You love asymmetry. You haven't mentioned asymmetric for a while, mate.
We've got to bring it back.
The asymmetry in banking is if I take this stupid risk and it pays off, I personally get paid $5 million.
Yes.
If I take this stupid risk and it doesn't pay off, I lose my job and I go and work for the other guy across the street.
Yes, exactly. That's a good bet.
I agree we should let the businesses broadly fail, including banks, as long as you don't screw depositors or the system in doing so. And I think that was the Lehman Brothers problem in the US, was that contagion problem. So that's why there's depositor insurance, or the banks are, the government's prepared to say, look, the bank might or may not go to the wall, depending on whether you're right or I'm right, but depositors will be okay. I think that's true with one exception, mate, which is when you say the investment committee sits around saying, if we do this, we might blow up the bank. I think deep down, there's a too large number of people in those institutions who say, yeah, but we'll get our $15 million bonus if it works, and we won't lose much if it doesn't, so let's just do it anyway. Or if not even that transparently, more opaquely, I've got a $15 million bonus if I can make this work. I'm going to try really hard to make this work. And I think I can because I think I'm smart. Mm. And so all of those human behavioral psychology biases and everything kind of comes to play right at this very point, which is, you know, I think I'll do it. I think it's okay. Everyone else is doing it, so I feel good about it. I'm taking all the precautions I can, and I stand to make $15 million. Mm-hmm. Or maybe I don't, and maybe nothing goes wrong anyway. Maybe I miss the chance of $15 million. Mm. Or maybe I do it and I lose my job. Those are the three outcomes. Mm. I'm still going to be like, well, I think I'll roll the dice for sometimes really, really nefarious reasons, sometimes just plain self-delusion. And my only concern with all of that is when you have the – so principal agent problem suggests that there is effectively a management team who are doing things in theory on behalf of the owners, but they're not the owners. Mm. And they have different incentives and different outcomes than the owners themselves. So on one hand, when we say let CBA fail, I think that's still the right thing to do, as long as you protect the depositors, by the way. Mm. But I also do feel for particularly the banks and the Woolies and Coles, and we kind of take exception to the mum and dad investor kind of label, because it's a bit patronizing, but there is, people like, our mums and dads who, are investing in CBA. They're not saying to the guys, hey, go and take these risks. They're assuming or hoping that the companies are being run well. And this is where I only step in, and probably more than you, on the extra bit we haven't really mentioned is just the regulation. So you can let it fail and say, push the boat out. If it sinks, it sinks. You can, though, say, boat's a little bit overloaded, guys. Take a couple of people out before you push the boat. If it still sinks, then that's bad. But we're going to try and make sure everyone's got a life jacket.
Yeah, I'm actually with you on that. Look, I should roll back some earlier comments there. Like, there is a huge, it's the Peter Parker thing, right? Great power comes great responsibility, and the banks have great power. If you're the government and you're going to issue a banking license, you just basically say, like, look, if you want to play this game, you must have a capital ratio of 20% or something. 100%. I would make it rather high.
Absolutely, yes.
No, we can't make profit. I was like, all right, don't do it. I would say the same to the gas companies, right? Like, this is the world. It's too much. Don't see you later. I'll call that bluff any day of the week. 100%.
Yep, agreed. Absolutely. I think you're right. The capital ratio. And the thing about these capital ratios, by the way, is it's an exponential line. Hmm. A company with a capital ratio of 10% is I'll go with 20. A capital ratio of 20% is not twice as safe as one with 10. It's going to be 10 times safer.
So much safer.
Because it's just the way those percentages work when you go from small to large numbers, it just changes the math so dramatically, because the size of the run, the rareness or the rarity of the run that causes that, it just becomes exponentially better off. The one that's 30% capital ratio is probably 100 times better than the one with 20%. It's just the way it works. Now, at some point, we're going to have to pay more for banking services if the bank's going to be profitable.
So that's the point. This comes full circle very nicely. Just to, you know, you said I'd be happy to pay a little bit more for a safer, and I think you would in other services. A lot of things that we get for quote unquote for free aren't really for free. Yeah. They're sort of to entice us there to attract our money. But I'm with you. I would absolutely prefer more bank charges, et cetera, if it meant that there was a far more robust system.
There you go.
With the caveat that there was a nice, as always, it's always the standard with me, but a nice open, competitively accessible kind of market to ensure that whenever there is anything too egregious, you know, someone else will go, well, I'll take your market share. Thank you very much. And that will keep things in check far better than any heavy-handed regulation. Although, you're right, you definitely need regulation to a degree.
Motley Fool Money. For more, subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener.
I'm glad you mentioned regulation. This is a wonderful segue into our next topic, mate, because God love our Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, who this morning, we're recording this on Thursday, the 11th of April, has announced that, as the AFR calls it, protectionism is the new competition. Mm. Now, let's assume the Finn might be slightly biased, because they can be sometimes, they're editorial. In any case, the PM has flagged massive new amounts of investment into lots of different industries, in theory to, I don't know what exactly, in theory to compete with the rest of the world somehow.
Because Australia.
Apparently it's going to be called the Future Made in Australia Act, which is just, you know what I was going to say, hate more than anything, I hate lots of things. Governments in the US have been doing this for years, right? They call it the Nebraska is the best state in the country act, or, you know, and Australian governments have been doing it where it's like, you know, repealing, rolling back bad regulation act, or they try and kind of, you know, put marketing titles on all this sort of stuff. This one goes even further because they're launching it, given the name, before the regulation or the legislation's even drawn up. Yeah, Future Made in Australia Act. I've voted for both parties in the past. We try and be apolitical here. I thought the last term of the last government was atrocious, frankly, the way it was run for lots of different reasons without being political. And whenever a government is replaced, you kind of go, oh, hopefully the new guys will do some things, at least for a while, right? New governments tend to be more principled. They tend to be, they have higher aspirations. Eventually they get worn down and chucked out. And that's kind of what happens. Hmm. And you kind of look at that and go, oh, really? You're doing that? Hmm. And that was what I thought this morning. It was just like this, there's a lot of stupid policies recently from both the government and the opposition. Hands up, Shadow Treasurer Taylor with the super housing as a start. This one, I think, almost takes the cake, mate, because the government decided. Well, they've decided they're going to spend billions and billions of Australian taxpayer dollar in subsidies and or tariffs. We're not really sure yet. It seems like it's going to be subsidies or direct investment in these businesses to do things that these companies can't otherwise do by themselves, which is the first clue. Because if a company can't do something by itself without government money, then that really means the taxpayer is effectively on the hook perpetually for this stuff. Now, let me be a little bit kinder, because there's plenty of partisans who already have hit me on Twitter this morning, and God love you. Thank you for engaging. Oh, no, it's only going to be seed capital. The government's going to start it, then it's going to stand on its own 2 feet. To which I reply, we spent 40 years propping up the car industry waiting for it to find its own 2 feet. It never quite got there. The frustrating thing about this, mate, is the Hawke and Keating Labor governments, the same party as everyone knows that is in power now, spent the best part of their first two or three terms dismantling tariffs, dismantling subsidies, dismantling protectionism, because it makes sense. It makes sense for us to trade with other people. If they can do it better than we can or cheaper, we should buy their stuff. And if we can do stuff better or cheaper than they can, they'll buy our stuff. We both win. We get to make the stuff we're good at.
It's called comparative advantage.
It is. And I had to share this with some people on Twitter, because it's not competitive advantage. It's a very different thing.
Yeah.
Comparative advantage talks about the opportunity cost of producing it. We could make iPhones in Australia. Mm-hmm. They would cost $7,000 to make, but we could do it, right?
Yeah,
we could absolutely do it. Yeah. So why don't we? Because the people who would otherwise work in that iPhone factory could work in other industries more profitably at higher wages for better economic outcomes for the country, including the fact we'd buy cheaper iPhones. That's exactly why comparative advantage. I think it's why globalization of foreign trade is so incredibly important. Now, people have taken issue with globalization. I would agree it's been poorly handled by politicians over the last 30 or 40 years in terms of making sure the consequences were dealt with such that people enjoyed and appreciated the benefits, because that's the other thing. Sometimes competition is fine, but if you don't recognize it, then the political changes can be wrought against it, which is exactly what's happening now. Mm. And I just, mate, I'm literally lost for words. I was on radio this morning. I don't know how to describe this. It is just such a terrible, terrible idea. Now, apparently it's solar panels and clean energy, and apparently it's safeguarding our energy future and all that kind of rubbish they throw at this stuff. Here's my issue with that. Sorry, I'll diatribe, then you can jump in.
Go for it.
People say to me, oh, no, what they're doing, they realize the geopolitics stuff. So what they want to do is make some panels in Australia. And I'm kind of like, if you genuinely think that the geopolitics is a risk, if you genuinely think our Australian economy and society is at risk, you're going to have to say to the Australian people, so here's the thing, guys. We're going to now reduce all of your standards of living by 25% tomorrow, and we are going to nationalize or create new industries in everything. We're going to have car industry. We're going to have to make our own phones. We're going to have to make our own computers. We're going to have to make our own clothes again, because you know, we may not be able to get them. If the South China Sea is blocked and there's a naval blockade, we're going to have to start drilling our own oil. That's going to suck. We're also going to have to smelt our own iron. I mean, you would have to create, at the very least, if you think China's the enemy, everything China does. If you think China can block access to Australia from foreigners, everything everyone else does for us. I mean, that's national prepping, which again you can do if you want to do it. But then have that conversation, or you say, well, we can't or won't do that. So let's stop trying to do bits and pieces and pretend that somehow make a couple of solar panels in Newcastle is going to save us from energy reliance on China. It is just not going to happen. So I don't know, mate. I called it stupidity this morning. I think it is. The madness of pretending this makes a difference in any other way than costing either more taxpayer money for subsidies or putting up the price of those imports for Australians. In other words, reducing our standard of living, because now computers cost $1,500 rather than $1,200. That just makes am I completely barking mad, mate? Because I think I'm going nuts.
No, let me try and fill it out a bit more. I mean,
fill in the gaps on my diatribe didn't quite cover.
I get the frustration. I share it. And I also, but I do get the desire though, because it feels good that things are made here. We feel like we can stand on our own two feet.
It's
we
in the
want
DNA,
more
isn't
local
it?
Jobs. Like, yeah. I mean, who's against that? Like, yeah. I don't think anyone is. The problem is though, is that when you add public money, that it distorts things. You get to a situation where these companies are only viable if they're subsidized. Take away the subsidy and they're not viable. And okay, maybe for some things that have a greater societal good beyond the economic well-being of that particular company, then okay, that's fine. But for a lot of these things, that's not the case. The only rational reason to really want to, like manufacturing, have that here, yeah, I would argue is for security grounds. So if you've got a pretty dark outlook on geopolitics, there is an argument because, you know, things get real. You want to be able to know that we can at least make some stuff here because...
But is some stuff enough though? I guess my kind of point is, what if we make 10% of the stuff here? It's like, well, the other 90% still doesn't get made. Like I'm still not sure on a risk-reward basis, you either say, I'm in, let's pull up the drawbridge and literally nationally prep. As in, you know, there's a doomsday prepper is kind of where that phrase comes from, in case people are wondering. Or you say, it could suck. Let's stockpile some stuff rather than having to make it here and just, you know, kind of work on, by the way, not having wars. And it's a pretty good incentive, right? I just don't get the halfway house. You can't be half pregnant, right? That's what this feels like, is a token effort to sort of say, well, maybe national security, well, maybe national capability, but not really in any meaningful way. So
And it depends on what you're making as well. Like national security doesn't depend on T-shirts, right? Like,
well, you don't want to see me walking down the street without a T-shirt, mate. maybe it does, is all I'm saying.
I guess I'm saying there is a strategic dimension to that. But you're right. But the broader point I was going to make is that trade is good for the very real reason that it makes things cheaper for it. It's mutually beneficial.
Yeah,
like the person selling and the person buying both get something out of this, right? It is a good thing, but it fosters global peace. If you're if you like global peace, I'll out myself. I'm a fan. Sign me up to the newsletter.
Yeah, I like people bombing and shooting at us.
I'm a supporter of that. You know, I'm anti-war and death. Okay, I guess you could say. And I tell you what, I think that tensions Look, there's every chance that the US and China would have already gone to war if they weren't so interdependent on each other for trade.
Yeah.
That is a massive, like, China can get very angry at the US and vice versa, but guess where most of the exports from China go to, right?
They need each other. Yeah.
They need each other. I mean, well, Neil Ferguson called it Chimerica, right? Which is a really great name because it's got the chimera kind of angle to it as well. And it's the portmanteau or whatever it's called, or the joining of the words, but it is phenomenally beneficial for both of us. So this is why we do it. The other thing is this: name for me one technology that came out of the Soviet Eastern Bloc countries, right? Like, or Cuba, or North Korea, or you know, whenever you try and distort industries, but you effectively break down the signal between consumers and manufacturers. Hey, I'm going to make this, and I'm going to make it because I think people will want it. Well, people don't really want it unless you make it a lot cheaper. So I'm going to artificially make it a lot cheaper by taxing you and then giving it to them that you can get it cheap. And you end up with this rubbish goods that no one really wants. Because there's no, again, I know it sounds really harsh. You want bad products and services to fail, or put better, you want the superior product as determined by each individual person's own desire and wants, whatever they happen to be spending their money on.
Yep.
You want that to flourish at the expense of all of the not so great stuff. You know, we'd all have Nokia flip phones still if someone didn't sort of come in, innovate, and no government decree said, actually, we're going to give Apple this much market share. No, the market did, because it's like turns out that an iPhone is a lot better than a Motorola flip phone, you know, not to just pick on Nokia. And that is how it should be. Now, for whatever reason, the people at Motorola had incredible good lobbyists, and they were able to sort of encourage the in my hypothetical parallel history, you know, support Motorola by, we need to manufacture this here and we need to blah, blah, blah. And it's just like, I know Motorola's not a US company. This is a terrible analogy.
Go with it. Push on.
I don't think it is anyway. Anyway, but my point is that we all suffer. Yeah. We all suffer. And it's not that we don't even get the feel good, well, at least we created some jobs here, because they aren't the kind of jobs that, I mean, those jobs are being funded through our taxes. The piper always pays, is what I'm trying to say. Exactly. I'm really trying.
That's the thing, right? That's here. Exactly the problem.
And if the piper isn't paying, it's because someone else is just venting more money somewhere else. It's like there's a cost at every level of this kind of thing. So I'm with you 100%. Albo, I get where you're coming from. I get it sounds good. I get it's got a good, you know, soundbite to it. But the reason that we don't do this stuff here is because we're not good at it. If we were good at it, we would do it, and we would do it not for the greater good, but because someone would go, hey, we're really good at this. I'm going to do this, and I'm going to make a ton of money doing it, and everyone's going to buy it. And that's why it's going to be good. So why do we supply all the iron ore? Why do we supply all the wool? Why do we? Because we're just better at it than any. You can't bring it, you know? Yeah. We'll go toe-to-toe with anyone on some of these fronts here, because no one can do it better than us. Not many people can do it as good as us. Let's lean into that. And guess what? We kind of have, and we kind of done really well as a result of it. So,
and that's the thing. You'd have to, if you want to start making solar panels, right, you've got to pull people off those farms, out of those iron ore mines.
Yes,
distort
the economy.
Out of the banking, not just distort the economy, but you actually replace something we have an advantage at and with. And you said to tell that capital, those people, go and do this thing that we don't do as well as they do.
Yeah. So we're the world chess champions. Right. Let's train everyone on checkers, right? Yes. Let's forget that. We're going to we're just going to play that game instead now.
Now, if a company wants to start up, I'm going to try and torture your analogy. If someone wants to become a checkers champion, they're entitled to do that. Yeah. And good luck. And if you do, then great. And maybe more people will join you, and maybe we'll have a nation of checkers champions and chess champions, which would be wonderful.
Yeah.
But just deciding arbitrarily, you know what? We're really good at chess. We're not very good at checkers. The Chinese do checkers better than us. And that's bad. So we should actually waste time, money, and effort getting good at checkers. We'll never be as good as them, but we'll pretend we can, just in case the Chinese take all the checkers away, we'll have some in Australia. I'm torturing the metaphor horribly. You get the idea. It's just madness.
Can I just be clear on something here,
please,
too? My worry is just reflecting on what we've both just sort of said here, is that it implies a ideology of laissez-faire economics and capitalism, let the market decide. And I say that a lot, but I've really got to be careful with the language here, because I don't think that. I know some people do. I don't think that. And it says, we were discussing off air, I think the government, what they need to do is they need to stop acting like the puppet master where I'm pulling all the strings. Yeah. And they need to be more worried with setting up the stage. to have another terrible metaphor.
That's where we both agree. You come across more free market than me or more whatever. I come across more regulatory or co-oversight than you. But that's exactly where we agree, which is the role of the government is to decide the playing field.
Yes.
And then let the players play.
Don't field your own player, right? Yes. So here's the problem as it's perceived. Yep. We don't make enough stuff in Australia. Yep. Now, let's look at it critically. Well, why don't we? Well, we've touched on the reasons why. We just don't have a comparative advantage in that. Is there anything that we could do to make it easier for people who make stuff? And there were people on the radio this morning. It's like, you know what? Can you get rid of all this stupid red tape? Like that I have to, you know. Now, again, I'm not saying throw all regulations out the window, but I think anyone who's operated in these industries will tell you, OMG. You know, there's a place in China which just pumps all its waste into the river and is done with it. We've got to do this. And again, it's like, well, good. But there's a continuum here. There's a spectrum. And a lot of this regulation, a lot of this compliance is very costly. And a lot of it is good and necessary in terms of intent and purpose, but badly implemented. And so when people operate businesses, and anyone who's run a business knows this, you've got 50 plates spinning in the air. I've got to look after that. There's this problem over there. I've got to put that fire out. Oh, and by the way, I need to hire an accountant and a consultant. We need to spend 6 months and 200 grand to make sure that the government thinks that we're not doing something wrong. And it's again, the government should be checking in on things, but do you have to make the burden so heavy-handed and so difficult and so bureaucratic? And so, like, let's clear the air there. Now, whether that particular industry or niche thrives after that, well, that is yet to be determined. But if you want to do something, that's the best thing that you can do. Don't get in there and say, I'm just going to start giving you money. And again, where does the money come from? It comes from us. It's either taxed or it's created out of thin air. So there's no free lunches. And then I think too often we expect in the modern world that it's just like, we could just solve every problem by throwing money at it. It's like, no, you turns out you can't.
And that's the thing. People say, well, we want to make your point. Like, there is something super, super deeply, I assume it's human, it may be cultural, either or, about making stuff here, right? We kind of, the idea of a physical good. Ross Gittins was on the Conversations podcast with Richard Feidler a little while ago, and I love Ross. We don't always agree with him, but I did on this one. He made the point. We've got to stop obsessing about the making of specific physical widgets. Mm-hmm. We're in a services economy, we're in a services world. Think about where is the growth of the economy? We've talked about AI ad nauseum, you know, digital products, digital software, services. Mm-hmm. That is the future of the economy. Why? Because we're all getting richer and wealthier and we're making products cheaper, easier, and more quickly. So we've got more discretionary income to spend on other stuff. Mm-hmm. Who's going to do that other stuff? Well, other people. And they're going to get paid more to do it. That's literally, it's literally progress. And I know people kind of look back and go, oh, we used to make televisions in Australia and we used to do this. And
yeah, and they used to be rubbish.
I know, right? Or cars. I mean, God love it. I had a VP Commodore back in the day and I loved that car. It wasn't better than the European alternatives or Japanese alternatives. It was cheaper because the government threw GM some money and said, can you please keep the price down? So, you know, made it easier.
Well, no. It was cheaper than it otherwise would be. It was still more expensive than the imports.
Well, it depends on the car.
Depending on the car and class. But generally speaking, Toyota just came in and crushed it, right?
Exactly. And again, because they do it better. So I think that's, you know, we all want to make stuff. I get it. And we all kind of want to think that we could go back to making stuff somehow without cost, or even some people want to believe that somehow it makes us better. And I think I will say very quickly, there is an absolute benefit in being a more complex economy. You know, we're derided sometimes.
You don't want to be a banana republic. Yeah.
Right. We're being derided as houses and holes, and that's frankly not even close to true in most cases.
A little bit true.
The holes thing. Like, mining employs a tiny fraction of Australian people. It's good for tax revenues, but it doesn't add that much to the physical economy other than the money gets channeled through the government. And that's not real, by the way. It's real money. But in any case, being more complex is good because it makes us more anti-fragile, to your point. So we should do more things if we haven't got enough complexity in the economy. And I mean complexity in a good way in this case.
Yes.
So that's positive. But wanting to make stuff is completely logical. It just, we don't have to. we need to get over it. Honestly, if you're listening and you think, well, I still like to make stuff, I was like, well, hang on. If you want to make TVs again or clothes,
have at
or
it. Whatever go it
is,
at it.
Well, not only, but if get you want there. Us to as a country, what you're really saying is, I want people to be paid less, or I want to be taxed more just so I can say we made this here. And you might want either of those things, and that's fine. Just be really clear that's what you're, if not deliberately or explicitly, you're implicitly saying, I want people to work for less more than they're earning now in a crappy job that means they can compete on price with China. Good luck with that. Mm-hmm. Or you're saying, I want to buy a television for $500 that costs $2,000 to make, and I want my taxes to go towards subsidizing a TV for everyone who buys one by $1,500 a unit, rather than letting them buy the same thing or better from overseas for a cheaper price and paying less tax. Those are the only two options.
The other thing that's worth touching on here is that when we speak of comparative advantage, and it's worth asking, well, why is it that places like China do have, well, where is their comparative advantage? It's ultra cheap labor. That's it. It same with India, same with Bangladesh.
They've got scale as well, and they've got proximity. There are some advantages. If you've got 1 billion people in your country, whatever you're making locally, you can make a lot of it. You're closer to other places generally, so your shipping is probably cheaper. And as you say, the wages are just bloody cheap.
Yeah, I mean, that's their advantage, and that's the one that they have exploited.
Yep.
However, I don't. There's actually a whole bunch of issues with that, human rights and stuff like that. Yeah, and this is complicated, because then you get into the internal politics of foreign jurisdictions and should they and shouldn't they? And well, I think so, but is it up for me to say? I don't really know. But I think one really interesting contrast with that is Germany. You mentioned Germany before.
Yes.
Germany is an industrial powerhouse.
Yeah.
But they don't make T-shirts.
Correct.
They don't make coffee mugs.
That's right.
If you want the best, you want the really good machining, you go to Germany. You want the best car, you go to Germany, right? Like, and guess what? They're a lot more expensive. So why is that? Well, it turns out that for a lot of the high-end manufacturing, the manufacturing I think Australia should be doing, you know, let me qualify that after our conversation, not should be doing, has the capacity to do if we so chose and could exploit certain intrinsic advantages that we enjoy. I've long said that we could do a lot of stuff in terms of value adding the commodities we dig out of the ground. We don't have the workforce advantage because I don't think we should start paying people minimum wage of 3 cents an hour. But this stuff is generally made by robots and very big machines. Mm-hmm. So you don't actually have a huge factory floor with 1,000 people on it. You might have some very high paid engineers and a bunch of very, very expensive equipment. Mm-hmm. And that's what Germany does. And that's why it can churn out kind of stuff. They have done that to a degree where they have built up the capital base. Capital's I wish there was a better word for it, because sometimes it means money, sometimes it means productive capacity and equipment. Human capital. I'm talking like something that can make something else, right? And that's money, true. So it's why it gets bundled together. But the capital base of Germany, in terms of the machinery, the infrastructure and everything they have, levels them up. Imagine if you're playing SimCity, if anyone knows those kinds of games, or those, you know, Satisfactory, or they're really fun games, actually. It's like, what do you want to do to get to the higher levels in the game? You've got to build up the base levels, right? And Germany has done that incredibly well, to the point where it's just like they're building products that no one in the world is going to do better than the Germans. And for us to give it and get to the point of where we can effectively compete, we have to build up so much of this capital base to kind of get there. But it shows you what is possible when a company leans into its comparative advantages and its strength. Yes. And that's what the Germans had. The Germans just had engineering know-how. They could have said, hey, this is brilliant. Let's go make a bunch of, I don't know, coat hangers and low end kind of stuff. No. We can't beat China on that. Tell you what though, MRI machines, let's make a few of them. China's not doing much of that at the moment. Let's make nuclear fusion cores. Let's make, I don't know. I'm trying to think of very high-end stuff that the Germans make, but they've done it and it's brilliant. So if you want to, it's very long deviation here, but if you're the prime minister and you, for whatever reason, want more manufacturing here, start with first principles and start with, well, what can we do that no one else can do? What do we got here in Australia? We've got excellent education. We've got a very educated workforce. Mm. Let's make sure that we churn out some more engineers and mathematicians and these kinds of people. Let's make sure that those that want to develop businesses in this space, they've got a very clear runway to do. We're not going to set up a lot of barriers to entry and everything to get in the way of that kind of stuff. And then let's have at it, right? We will develop technologies that we just happen to be better at than other people. And let's build on that. Like just as a company does, well, let's do a bunch of R&D. Here's a bunch of products. Which one works? Oh, this one works really well. Let's discontinue the other ones and let's just double down on this. And this is what we do now. And that's kind of how these things kind evolve. And it's not just let's build cars because we should build cars and here's a bunch of money. That is not going to end well.
Never does. Two quick thoughts. I had some people say to me, well, you know, we should have industry policy. Japan had industry policy. So did Korea. So does China. We're not competing on a level playing field. And it was kind of like what you've really said is that governments took advantage of ultra low wages in each of those countries at those points in time to build the capability you've talked about, mate. And I think
they scaled up.
Right. Yep. And that, as you would and do if you're a developing economy. We did the same with wheat and iron ore. I mean, literally, like, this is, you know, we, but once you're a developed country, you don't go back to being a developing country and subsidizing industry or wanting lower wages so you can somehow win this. There's no point. You don't want to win this war. We are, the other thing is we're a country of 27 million people. You know, people say, China and the US pay subsidies, we should too. It's like, really? Mm-hmm. You want to actually take on, you know, we need to be guerrilla fighters here. We're not going to win if we're lining up in the trenches across the combined financial might of the US and the EU and China. And, you know, you don't win that war. You can have subsidize up the wazoo. They could buy our economy. Yeah. And you know, we're the size of California, right? This is not a big deal. Mm-hmm. So if you want to play, you need to play. And this is the comparative advantage point you've been making, which is it's guerrilla fighting. It's like, what niches can we fill? Mm-hmm. What things can we do? What drafting can we do? What you know? What do they want that we've got that we can trade with them? Because they're the gorillas in the room. We got to make the best we can. And people, that's the other thing is this national kind of ego of we want to play. We want to sit at the big table. You know, we're very 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 fortunate. And frankly, our forebears have done very well to make us responsible global citizens. We built a very good small economy, and so we earn a right to sit at some of those tables because we're developed and we're wealthy and we've got some things to say and do, but let's not pretend we're fighting dollar for dollar. We're not, you know, if you're lining up for the arm wrestle with the US or China, you know, it's Mr. Puniverse versus Hulk Hogan. It's not, you know, there is no, you know, there is no, we're not going to win. You don't win this. People say, oh, well, it's not free trade. We should do the same as them. An arms race is just dumb. You don't fight these guys head on. You outflank them. You go around the back. You use subterfuge. You do whatever. And I'll give up the military kind of analogies here. But you find ways of winning that aren't direct conflict. That's how you do it. And that's what we should. That's what comparative advantage is all about.
You wouldn't think it was possible with this conversation. I'm going to try and bring it back to property.
At least you're honest, mate. At least you're honest.
Well, as you were talking there, I kind of thought, actually, what is Australia's comparative advantages? I'll come back to tourism in a moment because you mentioned that to me years ago and I've just so internalized that because, well, no one else has got the Great Barrier Reef.
Right?
That feels like a comparative advantage that we can lead into. No one's got Uluru. No one's, you know.
And people and culture and you know what we've got brand. And I say that literally because of all those other things you said are real things. People just like Australia and they like Australians. And that's
– Well.
Go on.
So the property is – I'm just going to try and keep this as brief and as narrow as I can. But property has obviously been in very high demand. And despite some of the challenges and increased funding costs and all the things that we've talked ad nauseum about, you know, the demand is still high.
Yes.
And part of that is the exploitation of our national brand because Australia offers something really cool. And again, you don't see it when you've lived here your whole life. But anyone who's traveled, particularly if you've traveled to – you know, what they call the global south or the developing world or places that don't enjoy the prosperity that we do, you think, OMG, right? So firstly, we speak English, right? So it's the international language. So it's very accessible. Like even people who aren't born in natively English-speaking countries, English is the obvious second language. You got that going for you. We've got brilliant security and safety. You've never seen a tank roll down Martin Place, right? you've got great social services, like free education, free hospitals, you know, all these kind of like, what is not to like here? And it's not to go too far down that path, but it strikes me as that is a big big part of our economy, as we all know, to maybe it's gotten too big. But I suspect it is that exploitation, not necessarily driven or designed as such, but that is a big factor in it. Wouldn't be the same property market if we were, you know, plagued by corruption and the odd civil war and our social services were crumbling or crumbling more than they are. How could that be used smartly? Well, I tell you what, if we want to attract more talent, more brains, more capital, like, hey, come live in Australia. We've got some great places to live. We've got beautiful beaches and we've got a wonderful, stable economy. The government's not going to do anything too crazy and confiscate your business or your assets. You know what I mean? Like, come here. And it's like, that's California's strength, by the way, right? That's how they've done so well. They've built this center of excellence because it was a beacon. It's a bit, I know how this sounds, but it was a beacon to the rest of the world. If you had, ask anyone from anywhere in the world who's got ambition and talent and a dream, it's like, where do you want to go to pursue that? I'm going to go to LA, right? Like, or the state, it's the US and Australia and Canada and New Zealand and other places around the world have sort of up there as well. I don't want to downplay our hand, but it's America, right? Or at least it was for the longest of time. And has that helped America? Yeah, that's helped America a lot.
Absolutely.
Like, look who runs NVIDIA or Tesla. They're all immigrants that came across and were nurtured within this wonderful system. It's like, again, what would I do if I was dictator for a day? It was like, I would do everything I can to attract the best and brightest in the world. And we've got the opposite problem in Australia. Mm. Well, not problem, we've got the opposite issue, which is that you're highly capable, talented person. You probably go and work for Google. You probably go into California. You probably go and work at, you know, the top medical facilities in Europe and stuff. We have a very well-known and well-documented brain drain here. And it is you talk about not exploiting your natural comparative advantage. It strikes me as that's a real miss for us.
I completely agree, mate. I think, you know, Brand Australia is incredibly powerful. There is a lot to be said for benevolent dictatorships, right? The we should be doing everything. To your point, we can choose, not to quote John Howard, but, you know, how many people come, who comes, when they come, how they come. We can literally, and to your point, we have
can
all
be
these
picky,
things,
right? We're the best looking, you know, bloke on the school. Yeah, we've got our choice of partners here, right?
Let's, absolutely, it's super powerful. And then you throw on top of that, but I guess I mean Brand Australia more broadly, right? Think about Australian wines. Think about Home Chairs and Treasury. Not that it matters, but you know, think about Australian infant formula and milk products. Think about
seafood,
tourism, seafood. And so you kind of think, you know, if you're in charge of Brand Australia, you do everything you possibly could. Mm-hmm. To really, and not just marketing, but actually make it happen. That's why the dictatorship is important. We want to be seen that way increasingly. We want to be the destination for tourism, for immigration, for education. Mm-hmm. We want to be the brand of choice, the national brand of choice for all of these produced goods that we can do as a comparative advantage. Mm-hmm. That's where the upside is, right?
And that's huge.
Because you get volume, you also get pricing power, which we all know about that. The value of that is enormous. I just think the opportunity for us to use that, as you kind of rightly point out, instead of deciding we're going to try and compete with China and solar panels, you know what also worries me a little bit, mate, is we've talked a little bit about, I've mentioned in the past, I think one of the great sadnesses of Donald Trump's ascension has been teaching other politicians they can just get away with stuff if they just pretend it doesn't happen or just push
there
on.
There are no consequences.
Right? Yeah. Right. So Nixon resigned, Barry O'Farrell resigned, Trump just marches on, everyone else says, I can probably do that too. Now, eventually gets you voted out, as he did in America, as arguably I think Scott Morrison made some missteps here that got him voted out eventually. So it has consequences eventually. But in the medium term, I think that's the pollies are happy to play to Australians' ignorance on economics. And even on Twitter, it's not exactly a representative sample, but I've had some people say, well, obviously we should make more stuff like we used to in the 70s, or obviously we should just, you know, they're playing protections, we should do it too. And none of those things are wrong as impulses. The hopefully the value we're adding here on this podcast, this episode particularly, but in general, is just that idea of you know, sometimes first impressions aren't right, or they're not the whole story. And that's where I worry about our politicians when they go down that populist route of, I could explain, or I could just go and try and chase some votes with some slogans. Mm-hmm. That's where things get ugly. And that's I guess, to kind of wrap it up, my biggest concern is the future Made in Australia Act is everything bad about sloganeering and everything bad about pretending that throwing some money will fix something, or that we can somehow compete, because we all want this national ego of, yeah, let's show China, or let's compete with the US. We'd like to do it in sport. We think somehow we can do it in economics just by saying, let's throw some money at this and build it here, as if there are no consequences, as if there are no side effects.
Sport's a great analogy here, because the kind of stuff that we're talking about takes decade-long thinking, like more.
Yeah, true.
You know, because it takes time. And then the reason I say sport is such a good example. Now, Australia is, as everyone listening knows, we punch well above our weight. And we love to think it's something intrinsic about Australians that just make us better at
Jesse
the
Bond.
Stuff. It's not. It's because decades ago, they invested a lot into the Institute of Sport. They put a lot of support around these kinds of things. And they recognized
schools, playing fields,
all of that kind of stuff. And guess what? That investment didn't bear fruit in the first year, or the second year, or the third year, or the fourth, because you know, Tim Cahill was four when some of these things came through. So I don't care how good a soccer player he was at the age of 12. It's just like none of that investment is paying off. But then it does pay off. Now, again, I'm not trying to make it about sport, or we should invest more or less in sport.
Yeah.
My point being is that we have these outcomes aren't an accident. These outcomes I heard someone interviewed not too long ago talking about the thinking and the planning that went into that.
Oh, right. Cool.
Yeah. What do we want to do here to be better on the world stage? Well, we've got to make sure that we've got this. And it was just, it's one of these programs, the exception to the rule, that was planned, and it seems, I don't know, maybe people who are closer to it can correct me, but it seems from the outside implemented pretty well. And now we have the benefit of that, but it took ages. And I reckon if you started implementing so you made me a dictator for a day and you set those rules in stone, I can just imagine like 3 years later going, well, that was good work there, bloody fellas. Page. Like yeah, that, yeah, they exactly. did nothing. Yeah. It's like, well, give it time, yeah, right? Because it is going, these things play out. But the nice aspect of that lag is, and we talked about this the other day on Strawman actually with some companies, is that when you're in that, it takes a long time to get in that position, but it also takes a long time for those that would compete against you to get into that position as well. So if you can build a bit of a lead there, a bit of a first mover advantage, if you will, you know, it's not that you're golden and you know, thou shall never be touched and disrupted, but it means that even if you do, it's going to be a slow death and you really have to screw up here. And so it's sort of, again, that comparative advantage is built up over time. And the potential is there, and it's just these jingoistic, short-term, myopic, populist kind of policies. I love your Albo, but this is a bad move, dude. And unfortunately, that not many people are going to listen to what are we up to now? Hour and a half podcast, which we've scratched the surface on, right?
Yeah.
And when you're just there at the voting, but everyone's trying to put that's food on the table and get things done, it's just like, yeah, I think we should do that. It works. That's the disappointing thing with all of this is that no one's going to listen to the complex, nuanced, but right answers, but I will listen to the easy but wrong answers and just get on with things.
Do you know what? One last comment from me. The other thing about this whole idea of let's do it here is, let's use the radiology machines in, or the MRI machines in Germany, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let's say we invested in trying to make radiology machines like Germany. And let's say we even got relatively good at it. So we've spent this money and time and effort and we're as good as Germany.
Mm. Yeah.
So where's the benefit? Yeah. There's something in the jingoism you talked about, mate. Americans talk about American exceptionalism, and I think there's some implicit exceptionalism in the way people want to think about Australia. And you know, you're seen as being disloyal or not having pride if you don't kind of follow this line. But let's say we do some of these things. Why do we think that if we then started to try to do that, we would somehow come out on top and permanently in some of these industries? I mean, companies in Australia struggle to be the best in any of their industries because there's competition. And so the idea of like, well, if we just started making solar panels, then we'd obviously be able to do it better and cheaper than everyone else. You know, even if we got to the point of starting this up and being somehow self-sufficient, the question still is, why would the customers, Australian or otherwise, buy from us? What are we doing better? Not just could we do it, but if you want to have a market in this thing, what are we doing better than everybody else and permanently better? Some people say, oh, we're going to have this new solar technology. Okay, so that'll work for the next 4 years. And the Chinese work out how to do the same thing. So what does that do with our early lead? Yeah, good for a while, Now, to your point, if you get to be Germany and making MRI machines after 40 years, the barrier is, do I want
to
try?
It's hard to catch up.
Right, do I want to try? But that's almost the thing, is like, if we're not doing new stuff, we're just trying to catch up with their old stuff, the chance of getting there is abominable. If you do get to as good, can you be as cheap? Probably not. If you get as cheap, can you get it there at the same time, at the same cost? Probably not, because we're at the other side of the world. The idea that just because if we start making it, we'll have markets all of a sudden open up to us because we do the thing. But but guys, we make these now, so you should want to buy them, right? It doesn't exist in anything other than these people's minds, unfortunately.
You've really just, got to end this damn podcast here, but you've really hit on something I think is important there, which is that it's this, there is a sense that these things need to be orchestrated and directed. And I think it's such a false starting point. It's like, no, if it's worth doing, someone will do it.
Right, exactly. That's exactly
because someone wants to get rich, thing. Right?
Yes.
Someone somewhere will do, and by the way, someone somewhere will do all kinds of dumb things. And every single day, someone opens up a stupid business and it fails a year later. And it's kind of like, it's great. It's like it's a natural selection, evolutionary kind of thing at it. It was just like, we're just, all these
iterative process,
hairless apes are just doing all this stuff. Why? They're not because they've got grand visions for the future in society, because like, I want to get rich. That's right. You know, and I've got a passion. I think other people would like this solution. I think I can do it better than the other solution, and I'm going to do it. And the great thing about capitalism, it's just like, fill your boots, brother. If you want to go and do that, knock yourself out. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
But the point is that your incentive is to make money. To make money, you must create value. Mm-hmm. To create value, you must be able to do something better than someone else can do.
And so, exactly.
No one's planning this. If I just rock up to your local market one day and I'm selling a jam that is just out of this world and just knocks everyone, I don't need some bureaucrat to sort of say, now listen, everyone, Andrew's jam is made with a little bit better ingredient locally. You employ some local, you need to come over. It's like, no, people will just do it. And the person who's making the really sticky, awful, disgusting stuff over there is just like, no one's buying this. And then what comes out of that organically is the better result for everyone. And no one had to plan it. No one had to orchestrate it. People are just throwing stuff at the wall and they see what sticks, and the stuff that sticks, we double down on. And that is progress. It's just so stupid to sit there at the very top and go, we need to do this and I'm going to make this happen. It's like, no, just get the hell. That, again, America's superpower has been that fostering of entrepreneurism, private property. I mean, America does a whole bunch of stuff really wrong, so I don't want to come out as too much of a cheerleader for it, but they get that part really right. You can start a business and fail, and it's not as consequential as it is here and in other parts of the world. And it's like, it's a good thing, right? It's because it allows that natural experiment to play out. It allows the better things to percolate to the top. And it's why, you know, when you want the best solutions for you individually, selfishly, and also for society at large, you've got to let that process run its course, because it's beyond any one individual or group to plan, foresee, coordinate any of this kind. That's the first thing that you've got to understand, despite your intentions. And this is where even the idea of a benevolent dictator is dangerous a little bit, because like, I'll do this because it's the best, but there's 50 other unintended consequences I didn't think of and that are going to come and bite me in the butt. So it's just, I just make that point. It should be an organic process. And once you recognize that, the way that when there are quote unquote problems, the way you address that, as we said before, it's more about changing the field rather than changing the players, so to speak. And you will find that good things just tend to happen. You know, there's pain along the way, but like anyone in any aspect of life, growth, a pain leads to growth, right? And you kind of need a little bit. You don't want too much, but you kind of need a little bit just to keep us sharp and keep us moving forward.
I'm going to add to that only very briefly, mate, just to say that people will say, well, government has to invest to do this stuff. And I just want to mention that Twiggy and Mike Cannon-Brookes are going to invest a total, I think Twiggy's out now, but the Sun Cable project, sending power to Singapore, is going to cost $30 billion to get up and running.
How much did I have to pay of that?
Zero.
Oh, well, who told him to do it?
No one.
Oh, so no one told him to do it. It didn't take any of my money. What if it does really? What if it generates a lot of value for people? Will he do well?
That sounds like he probably that he probably would be
will. Okay. What if it's a terrible idea? What happens then?
Well, it'll go broke.
Okay. Yeah. So, but what does that mean for me?
Oh no, nothing. It's all good.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But if it does work, I'll probably get cheaper power or something, right?
Like, yeah, good for the economy too. So, probably more tax revenues and yeah.
And I'm just surprised that this happened without anyone in Canberra coordinating this. You know?
Now, I will say, I do think there are times when seed, the one exception.
Yeah, you can't be black and white.
I was going to shut up. Seed investment can be useful. My point was just people will say, no, we need to do this because without government money, these things won't get done. And that might be true for some small projects, some specific projects.
Case by case, yep.
But Twiggy and Mike Cannon-Brookes threw in $30 billion for this project. Mm-hmm. They didn't need governments to put the money up or the idea that you need seed capital from government can and maybe is sometimes necessary, but it's not always necessary. We shouldn't allow ourselves or other people to default to that. Well, obviously they have to, so therefore everything should be waved through because nothing can get done without it, because it's just not true.
Maybe the solar panels was a good example. I have to think this through, but what you're getting at there is, I think, whenever there's a chicken and the egg problem, sometimes you do the products and services that we're talking about, they just need a bit of investment capital to get going, right? And it's hard and they're volume-related games and they're just not going to work at small scales. So you say, look, you know, we're going to prime the pump here a little bit. So we're going to incentivize this. We're going to give you tax breaks. We're going to give you R&D grants. We're going to do all of this kind of stuff. But just to a point, right? Yeah. The fact that we give diesel subsities to the big global mines, that is the most insane thing in the world. Correct, just fine without that, guys. Yes.
R&D discounts to multi-billion dollar businesses.
That's nonsense. Right, yeah, it's nonsense. So I get your point, and I think it's a good one because we've got to avoid being black and white on this stuff. There are cases for it, but more often than not, probably it's best just to get out of the way.
And with that, I will get out of the way because if I answer, Andrew will answer, and if he'll answer, I'll answer. And then
one more thing.
We're 2 hours in. We will put a pin in it, as Andrew likes to say, at this point, very early on in the podcast. Circle back, asymmetric outcomes. I'm not going to say it. I'm going to simply say thanks for listening. We'll see you on Sunday and fool on.
Cheers.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.